this is what the sum total of our life experiences taught us about what music should be. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where we are with things.
And the record's called The Terror End of Beauty.
The Terror End of Beauty.
Gibbs, thanks for being here.
Dave, thanks for having me.
How are you?
I'm good. You know, running around, but it's good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for making the time.
Oh, most definitely.
I just want to jump right in. We were listening to this track from the new Harriet Tubman record called Farther Unknown. And one of the things that struck me about all the music you've been involved with, and, you know, we're going to go back a long ways, but this is a recent thing that's just coming out, and you talk about heritage a lot, lineage, tradition, you know, where the music comes from and the history of the people who make the music. And in particular, this track, this record, you've talked about the Gullah Geechee element in the music. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the Gullah Geechee culture is one of my native cultures. My father's from down there, from one of the islands.
South Carolina?
He's from one of the South Carolina islands, mm-hmm. Yes. The Sea Islands basically stretch from Charleston down to Savannah and then actually a little even past there. And the culture itself goes all the way down into Florida with, you know, the Seminole culture is also part of the same culture. Mm. My father's side of the family is from the islands that are closer to Charleston.
Wow. And it's a language and
it has
music,
its own language that, back when I was a kid, was, I don't want to say stigmatized, but actually it kind of was, you know. And the relatives who came up from South Carolina, they used it regularly, but it wasn't like, it's not like a native language for me. But because I spent a lot of time around my grandmother, I kind of had to learn it.
And that was in Brooklyn.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. Yeah. My grandma lived in various ghetto communities across New York City, first in Far Rockaway, then in East New York, then in the South Bronx. And I was kind of her favorite, and so I spent a lot of time around with her.
So you picked up some of the language.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, the thing is, it's actually very, the neighborhood I grew up is a West Indian neighborhood in Brooklyn. And a lot of people, when I was a kid, and even still on the phone, people will think I'm Bajan from Barbados. And the Barbados patois and Gullah are very similar. And of course, it's very similar to the Sierra Leone.
Is that right?
Yeah, language. There's a lot of commonalities between these languages. So, And even, you know, it was funny. I was listening to that the New Orleans chant, the one. I was in the house and I was kind of just laying around and the thing came on and it was like Giacomo Fina, hey, and I was kind of like, oh, they're actually talking. There's a Gullah word in there. I mean, Fina is field. This is forest, and I was kind of like, oh, okay, it's kind of like, you know, the part that's important, the reason and the kind of catalyst for this song. I mean, Wamala Island is on a song I wrote for the Power Tools record, and that was kind of my first ever writing something about that. That's the island, that's the particular island my dad is from, and that was kind of like a song for him. Father Unknown is actually the next iteration of that. That's actually for my great-grandfather, a man named Solomon Gibbs, who I found out about when I was doing my family research. And, you know, there's a few different levels of why I kind of fixated on great-grandpa. And one of them is, you know, and I have the recording, I'll probably stick it in a record at some point. When I asked my father, I said, you know, I sat down and did the interviews, and I said to him, Dad, tell me about great-grandpa. And he kind of said, Grandpa. Grandpa never worked for the white man. And once he said that, that kind of ruined my week, month. Because you were talking like turn of the century,
yeah,
America. And we're talking someone who managed to have his own life, define himself according to his own rules. And, you know.
In that part of the world.
And, yes. Yeah. And, you know, that was very, you know, very heavy for me. You know, mm. I'm in New York. I'm hustling, trying to be a musician. And mm-hmm. great-grandpa's like, I'm living my life, dude. You know, so. Anyway, so that's one part of it. And the other part of it is this thing I've been on for the past year, heavily on it for the past kind of year or so. And it's this thing about dealing with African-American rhythms. And the particular kind of conceit, the kind of compositional conceit of this song is that the song is based around a very old African-American rhythm called Patting Juba that was shown to me by the drummer, body percussionist, David Pleasant, who's also Gullah Geechee. He's from one of the islands that's closer to Savannah. Mm-hmm. And he showed me this rhythm. It's a very old rhythm. What we call ham bone is a kind of derivation of Patting Juba. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's interesting about Patting Juba is that it's what I call a multi-rhythm. It's a simultaneous 3-8 and 4-4, 2-4. So you have these kind of multiple cells of rhythm that go back and cross.
And that's where that guitar part is coming out, kind of running against the underlying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I always say. It's, you know, it's simultaneously. So it kind of comes, I call it a weave. It comes together and it kind of falls apart. And that's one of sort of the defining features, I think, of African-American rhythms is the fact that they kind of come together and fall apart that way. I always say that there's no way you could get to Elvin Jones through Havana, but you have no problem getting to him through Charleston. And that's because of the, you know, those same kind of
wow.
things that sound like they're falling apart. They're actually derivations of this multi-rhythm. And one of the interesting things that about this particular thing is when I first showed the rhythm to JT, I didn't find this out till last week, but when I first showed the rhythm to JT, Brandon had a flashback to the late 70s being up in Northampton Amherst and doing this kind of workshop with Max Roach. And Max Roach was trying to show everybody a particular rhythm and nobody was kind of catching it. And it was pretty much the same thing that I was showing to JT.
So you feel like that's the underlying pulse of African American rhythm.
It's one of them.
It's
one of
them. But there's a central place.
Yeah, I feel
in
like
all
yeah,
of the music.
Yeah. I mean, I have a whole, you know, at some point I might write a book. I do different.
Yeah.
When I do master classes, I touch on different aspects of the commonalities and difference between African American music as opposed to different musics in the Western Hemisphere and their relation to, you know, their root in Africa or whatever.
And anybody who doesn't know, Melvin has a kick-ass Twitter feed where he lays out a lot of these.
Yeah. And I, you know, the stuff that I've kind of shown to kids, I share the kind of deeper stuff I haven't verbalized yet.
Right, and that is sort of the piece that we heard. That's where that's coming from.
Yeah, that's where the rhythmic aspect of it is coming from. I split the rhythm up basically between Brandon and myself on the top, and JT's kind of bringing it together. The thing is, it's actually a rhythm that's a body percussion rhythm.
Uh-huh.
So you can't actually accurately play it on the drums.
Right.
But JT did a very nice derivation of
it. Yeah, absolutely. So just to switch track a little bit, but it's still, I think, on the question about heritage and lineage and where does this music come from. One of the interesting things about this record was that you're all talking about how Ornette's gone, Ornette Coleman, and Cecil Taylor's gone, and Ronald Shannon Jackson is gone. And they are these leading lights of what we think of as the avant-garde. And I wonder how much you feel like that's a torch that you hold, like that's an important part of what you are doing currently moving forward.
Well, I feel like it's a very important part. I mean, it's kind of like those guys sat down and showed us stuff, you know what I mean? And it's kind of like, not Cecil so much for me personally, but, you know, I spent, you know, significant time around Ornette.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, the AACM guys, you know, through with Brandon, we spent a lot of time around Henry. You know, I played with Lester Bowie back in the day. I was in Defunct with Lester's brother. You
yep.
know, I came yep. up around the AACM bad guys. Those are my guys. You know, I was in Rashid Ali's band when I was 19 or whatever. So
what year would that have been? I wasn't aware of that.
Well, that's a whole other side story. I was basically, there was this kind of sort of, you know, now we name every genre, but there was this sound of mini movement like in the early 80s that they named Free Funk. And that's basically when all the other avant-garde guys kind of refreshed their band. They got everybody from our generation in and brought our rhythmic information in. And I was pretty much like the official bass player of that movement. I played with everybody. I played with everybody doing that.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Wow. Okay, so let's just hear a little bit of that. It's, I think it's your first studio record
yes.
with Ronald Shannon Jackson,
yes.
Decoding Society. So I thought we'd hear a little bit of Orange Birthday.
Yes.
Orange Birthday, Ronald Shannon Jackson, the Decoding Society. So you're literally your first date in the studio?
Literally my first thing that got released.
1980, right?
Yeah, I guess we recorded it in 79. It came out in 80. And yeah, it was my first thing that actually made it. You know, I'd been in the studio with other people, but, you know, it didn't make
it. So I thought, and obviously it sounds like I'm wrong, but I thought maybe Sonny Chirac was sort of your first association of being at, like I saw a video of you or a photograph of you with him.
No, that was after all of this. And that's actually a really funny story because I basically kind of like followed him around like a puppy till he put me in the band. But that was kind of after that. My first entrance into that whole scene was through the St. Louis guys hanging out. But how I met Shannon was I was in a band that band called Band of Music. It was led by a man named Adrian Day. And it turned out that Adrian actually had been playing, he was the drummer in this band, but he was actually the percussionist in Primetime for a while. And he had Burn Nix in the band. And I was playing with them. You know, I didn't really know who Burn was then. You know?
But was Burn already playing with Ornette Coleman?
Yeah, they were playing.
Time?
Yeah. This was
Primetime.
78, 79. So they had already recorded, you know,
yeah.
Dancing in Your Head and Body Matter. And I didn't actually put two and two together that he was that same person until a little while in. But anyway, one day we came from rehearsal and he pulled out this, he kind of said to me, "Hey, man, I think you can play harmonica." And so he's kind of hang out after rehearsal. So he hung out in rehearsal and he pulled out this kind of weird looking piece of music. And we played it. And he's like, "Yeah, great. You know, my friend Shannon Jackson's looking for a bass player. You should go, you know, I'm going to give you his number." So that's how we hooked up. But an interesting thing that simultaneously with that is something that I always tell people, because these two strands come together. The first band I was ever in was with a guitar player named Alfonia Timms. And Alfonia died very young, so a lot of people don't know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
But Alfonia was very important to my development. He's actually fairly important to downtown music in a way. And it was turned at the time I started playing with Shannon, Alfonia was playing with Blood. You know, and I hadn't seen him for years. I ran to him. James Blood Ulmer. And it went from that, long story short, because the story is kind of long and there's a lot to talk about. He ended up becoming Ornette Coleman's protege.
Oh.
And so we had like the face-to-face tutelage of Ornette for a while. And I mean, one of the greatest things, you know, Ornette said, you know, I'll always remember, you know, Alfonia didn't really kind of give me enough information, you know. Anfani was like, okay, we're going to go play at this, you know, at this loft. And he told me it was on Prince Street. You know? And then I kind of got there and I got to the building and then I kind of realized where I was going. And so we get up to
the
Arnest.
Private residence.
Yeah, exactly. And then we get there and it was basically, it was me, Anfani, and the drummer. And we basically gave a private concert for Arnett.
Wow.
For like an hour. He just sat there and listened to us and didn't say anything. Hmm. And then we finally stopped, you know, maybe not an hour, maybe 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And we stopped playing. And literally the first question Arnett asked was, Melvin, where'd you learn how to play like that? And it's kind of like, that's just how I play. You know, it's just what I do, you know. And that was pretty much, you know, in any other circumstance I was with Arnett, Arnett would kind of like pose these like cryptic questions to everybody else, but he kind of never did that with me. He was just kind of like, okay, you're good. You just do your thing.
Yeah. Wow. Did you already know Vernon Reed at that time?
Oh, we're buddies.
You go way back, right?
Yeah, we're buddy buddies. We're buddy buddies. We had a band together, you know, 3 or 4 years. I know him from... when did I meet him? I guess I met him in 76. Yeah.
Wow. In Brooklyn,
In Brooklyn, yeah. Yes. In the practice room of... No, not in the practice room. Another very good friend of mine, which is the other kind of side of this. There's a lot of things that weave in and out to make this story complete. We met through a very good friend of mine, a man named Gary Fritz, who everybody knows, who people in the music business know as a percussionist because he played with Roberta Flack for a long time, played with George Benson. He is also, everybody from our neighborhood knows him because he's one of the original graffiti, like, legends.
Wow.
And he was the leader of what was basically the graffiti gang, which was a group called the Ex Vandals. And I met Vernon through him because Vernon was in his band. And we hung out and we hit it off immediately. We just started doing stuff and became good running
buddies. And you've been playing with him ever since?
Ever since.
And you went to Medgar Evers College, I saw, and then you went to Berkeley?
No, that's...
That's not true.
I've tried to get that fixed. I'm getting fake news. Yeah, some straight up fake news. Don't believe everything you read on Wikipedia.
So did you go away from New York, though, at any point to go to, like, music school? Or was it all just here?
No, it was a school of hard knocks playing. Uh-huh. My school was, you know... as Byrne used to call it, the Harmelodic Academy. You know, my school was, you know, a lot with Arnett. I mean, but the thing is, the real root of all of everybody my generation was, we had, in Brooklyn, we had an organization called the Muse, which was a cultural organization. And the great jazz musicians of Brooklyn taught us as teenagers how to play. Like, the acoustic bass teacher at the Muse was Reggie Workman.
Wow.
He's literally, like, the first person who taught me how to play bass. And there was a woman there that we called Miss Lucy, who taught electric bass, she's like the foundation of all of us. Huh. And she was Larry Lucy's wife. Larry Lucy was the second guitar player in Count Basie's band. Mm. She was kind of this iconic electric, you know, it's funny, like females in electric bass, you know, it's like that was the one instrument that women always gravitated to that they never... No one ever kind of had any prejudice against them playing that instrument. So
interesting.
In Brooklyn, there were two between her, Miss Lucy, and Edna Edet, who was the head of the music program at Mega Evers, who was also a bass player, She was a bass player for International Sweethearts of Rhythm. Mm. And it was between the two of them that a lot of us bassists in New York got our thing from.
That's amazing. Okay, so I'll get to some more music, but I want to ask you about one name that I notice comes up a lot between you and Vernon, and somebody that I just barely passed by when I first got to New York, and that's Arthur Rames.
Oh, Arthur, it's funny. It's like James Brandon Lewis, me and him are supposed to have like a big sit down and talk about Arthur. Arthur is kind of like, he's this iconic musician from our neighborhood, and we hold him dear because he was one of us. He was our age. I mean, I guess he was a couple of years older than me and Vernon. And he was just virtuoso on multiple instruments. Amazing guy. That was like a kid. I mean, I always tell people, you know, there's a point where I kind of stop talking about my youth because it starts to sound like I'm name dropping.
Yeah.
But on one hand, we had, you know, Arthur. who was this amazing guy, you know, who played every instrument incredibly well. And to the point where, you know, when Rashid heard him, Rashid had him in the band. They used to do duets.
Tenor sax, yeah, exactly. Piano, yeah. Guitar.
Yeah, and we knew, I mean, he was the inspiration to us as a guitar player. He was mm-hmm. this really kind of post-McLaughlin sort of amazing jazz fusion guy who had this really incredible jazz fusion band called Eternity mm-hmm. that has kind of like made its mark on all of us of a certain generation. You know, definitely all the Brooklynites and, you know, everybody else. I'm sure you, if you talk to like Omar or Marcus Miller yeah. or any of those guys, they'd be like, oh, yeah, remember Arthur. Because he
left
had that,
way too soon.
Yeah, way too soon. Really iconic. Really. I mean, it's kind of like to talk about it. We always talk about him, and then people kind of like, yeah, yeah. But then when they actually hear what he did, everyone's. I always get the phone. I can always tell because I get the phone calls back. Arthur, it's like, oh, you finally actually listen.
Well, there's a few YouTube clips that have surfaced.
Yeah,
some are just recordings, and some so people can go check out. It's Arthur Rames, Rhames, yeah. Really important, yeah. Seminal figure who. Doesn't get talked about yeah. enough, I think.
And the thing that was most important about Arthur, I'm not most important because he was an amazing musician. Mm-hmm. He was a very inspirational. Mm. I mean, you hear this guy playing like this, and it's not like you hear him and you're like, man, I'll never be able to do that. He was our age. He was one of us. So we heard him. We're kind of like, well, if he can do it, we can do it. Mm-hmm. So we go home and practice more, you know, mm-hmm. and that's kind of like, that's why all of us were all at such a high level, simply because... He
raised everyone up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Mm. That's amazing, yeah. So, big gear switch, but I'm going to play this track that you recommended from Ardo Lindsay. So this is now, we've skipped a few years, but this track is called Invoke. So that's Invoke, you with Arto Lindsay. You and he produced it together.
Yeah. This is a co-write. This is a song me and him wrote together, and it kind of evolved out of... The first idea was to make a cover version of this kind of iconic Caetano Veloso song that Caetano sang in English called, you know, 9 out of 10, I believe is the actual name of the song. But then it just didn't work in the studio, so we kind of reworked it and we turned into that. And I really love that song because it was like not one of my first, but I really like the rhythm on that. I mean, it's a real synthesis of a few things I was thinking about rhythmically, and it kind of really works well. And it's funny because Ardo did a Candomblé record that's got a lot of Candomblé rhythms on it last year, and then we pulled this run out. It's like, hey, I kind of nailed it on this one. So I was pretty happy about that. And I really like Ardo's vocal that he delivers. It's this real kind of androgynous thing that I really like. And I also like it because we had the participation of one of my friends that I don't really get to work with that much anymore, a great keyboard player named Mark Batson, who kind of did the real kind of interesting kind of Brooklyn-esque kind of R&B keyboard thing in that context that I really love. One of the things I want to touch on, I was saying that, you know, my neighborhood, the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, Flatbush, Didmus Park, you know, PLG, whatever they're naming it, you know, they're calling my area like Prospect Park South now, you know. We were all teenagers, so we didn't really think about it like that. But on one hand, we had the amazing Arthur Rames. On the other hand, as I told you, my friend Gary was, you know, the leader of the graffiti artist mm-hmm. gang. So I knew all of those guys as just like guys that I knew. And there was this one kid who came around a few times that back then he called himself Samo. And everybody else knows him as Jean-Michel Basquiat. Hmm. And he's one of the kids from the neighborhood, too. So on one hand, you have Arthur Rames.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you got Jean-Michel. And I guess I hadn't, you know, I used to see Jean-Michel, you know, in the neighborhood because he would come by to visit Gary. And I didn't see him, you know. until I kind of started hanging with the St. Louis guys, and then I ended up playing in a band called The Contortions with
James Chance.
With James Chance. And then, you know, I was in that set of people that he was around, so we started running into each other all the time again.
Are you on the record by The Contortions?
No, I'm not on any Contortions records.
Oh, okay. I just played in the band.
I ended up quitting the band before I didn't record. What ended up happening was that second version of The Contortions ended up becoming a band called Defunct, which is, you know, that's my little piece of, like, you know, thing that I don't even brag about. One of the fun facts about me is there was a band out in L.A. that was really into us.
Into Defunct.
Yes. And they actually, the first song, when I met their bass player, he told me that the first song they ever wrote, he stole one of my bass parts to write the first song I ever write. And this is some kids from Fairfax High School, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yeah.
So
that's kind of Defunct.
Like, yeah. So that's my little. That's in one hand, Defunct isn't well known as some of the other bands of that no wave thing. But on the other hand, we can say we started.
So a few years after that, you did this thing called punk jazz, punk funk all stars.
Yeah, that was like
with Joe Bowie.
Yeah. What I did was basically put all the guys together from that time:
Ronald Shannon Jackson,
yeah,
Vernon,
yeah,
James Blood Ulmer, and yourself.
Yeah. And we pulled this thing, yeah.
Because I have a live recording from 2006. I'm just going to play a little tiny bit of this.
I actually love that recording.
We Dance Together.
Yes.
Who's singing?
That's Joe.
Okay. Sounds great. Dance Together.
Yeah, that's
Punk Funk All Stars. You were the leader.
Yeah, I put that thing together because I was the original bass player in Defunct, also in the Decoding Society. I actually never played with Blood because the timing just never worked out, because, like I said, I was actually literally doing everything. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I was doing I was playing all the time in those days. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I didn't really. And Amin's a great bass player anyway, so Blood didn't really need me. So anyway, I wanted to do something where I put everybody together because I wanted to play with everybody, so I put that thing together. Yeah. And that song is a song that's on the first Defunct album. Mm-hmm. And I actually really like that performance because it kind of falls apart in that harmonic way that's really, you know, it sounds like you're not doing it on purpose, but you actually are. And it falls apart and it comes back together in such a great way. I just love listening to that.
Wow, that's great. So we kind of skated by Arto Lindsay,
right.
And I got a tweet from somebody that said you have to ask him about.
Well, I was saying that
you've known him a long time.
I was talking about linking back up with John Michel, because I was part of the No Wave scene, and during that time. Basically, my home base was a place called the Squat Theater because I used to leave my clothes there.
Where was the Squat Theater?
The Squat was on 23rd Street, down the block from Chelsea Hotel. That building where the clock is now, that's basically next to the movie theater. It was either that building or the building next to it. I have to look up the address or somebody who else was there. Mm-hmm. And it was a Hungarian theater troupe lived there and ran it. And Esther, who was in Stranger Than Paradise, her family lived in there. I mean, I knew her when she was like, you know.
Right.
I guess 11, Small. 12 when, you know.
He's gesturing at like three, 4 feet high.
Yeah. She was just becoming like a teenager when we were doing all of this. And anyway, it was. And I went there one day to pick up my clothes because I was there all the time. And I heard this like ridiculous like noise / music coming out of downstairs. So I went down there and there was these three people playing, this wild looking bass player, a Japanese woman on drums, and this kind of dude playing something that kind of sort of like guitar, but not really. And I just kind of stood there and just watched them for a while. And then they stopped playing, and I kind of introduced to myself. And it turned out it was DNA. And that's when I first met
Ikoe Mori.
Yeah, Ikoe was on drums.
On drums.
Yes, Ikoe was on drums. Love her drumming, I have to say. Love her drumming. Yeah. Tim Wright on bass, amazing bass player. And Ardo. And that's when we met, was then, you know what I mean? And we kind of, I was doing whatever I was doing, he was doing whatever he was doing, and we kind of linked back up. I ended up, you know, in the mid-80s, I ended up working in Tower Records. And literally the first day I started working there, Ardo comes strolling in. It's like, hey, where have you been? I've been looking for you. I just started a band. Or he hadn't just started a band, he made a record. And that's when that point he was doing the Ambitious Lovers. So I participated in the Ambitious Lovers stuff with him. You know, Ambitious Lovers was him and Peter Scheer. And Peter Scheer was a great keyboard player, programmer. But, you know, I played bass and they had me play bass on the second records. And then, everybody kind of moved on and I was doing my thing and, you know, I had my rock band and we signed and then I ended up in the Rollins band and doing all of those things that, you know, in that world. And he started working on his Mundo Civilizado record, and that was kind of around the time where, to me, it was kind of obvious that the Rollins thing was, you know, I could see the handwriting on the wall at that point. And so I kind of jumped back into working with him, and you know, it worked well, and he liked working with me, and it kind of, that relationship grew,
and it became more a production relationship than just pure bass playing.
Yeah, because I was also doing all kind of production at that time. I had my own label, and was doing hip hop stuff as well, so you know, I knew how to work samplers and all of that kind of stuff.
And you'd been producing for Rollins Band too, but Rollins Band didn't last that long. I mean, it was a fairly short window.
Well, it was a 5-year window.
5 years,
which is long in the pop world.
I guess you're right.
It's long enough. I did some remix stuff, and I'm actually doing anything, but I was, you know, the band wrote everything together, so that was my contribution to that, to that era. And yeah, it was a great time. And you know, and it's interesting because that was also an interesting time for the free jazz scene in New York, because that's when Matthew was kind of arguably at his height ship, and that's when Charles Gayle was doing his thing, and David Ware, that whole crew was really kind of in their bloom at that point. And Charles Gayle came and sat in with us a few times. Wow. We have some sessions with him as
with
well.
With Rollins Band.
So, but, so that was the relationship. A lot of my relationship, going back to Ardo, I actually started off playing percussion. So a lot of my relationship with Ardo is because of my understanding of rhythms and my adaptability with being able to deal with Brazilian music without, you know, with a certain facility that a lot of Americans don't have. So.
And Ardo's background is so strongly in Brazil.
Yeah.
And with Brazilian artists.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
And through him, I've gotten to meet and play with a lot of really great people. I got the honor of playing with Caetano Veloso. I played with a woman named Marisa Manchi, who Americans don't know, but she's had many number one records in Brazil. And I played on a few of them.
That's
so
great.
It's been a really, you know, fruitful and creative relationship.
Yeah. But also something that led you towards making your own record as a leader.
Yeah.
The first time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually made a record in the 80s that's very hard to find. That's just called MG. That was kind of like a funk thing. And there's a kind of like, there's a one-off thing. I had a thing on, there was a record called This Is the Funk that I had one track on. But yeah, it took a while before I actually said, I mean, I had my rock band, which was I and I, which made a record for Sony in 90.
Right.
But my first kind of like thing, you know, my first Melvin record,
you put together all the music and it's a cast of thousands.
And a cast of thousands.
And a very strong conceptual statement.
Yeah.
And, right?
Yeah, and I should say before that, that was, you know, that record was an iteration of a project I'd been doing in the OO as a band I had called Liberation Theology, which was... The short version of Liberation Theology was, it was basically like a kind of modern funk band, and I want to say modern, I mean like kind of post-hip-hop funk band, with an entire Cuban religious group inserted into it, with how many guys would show up, 3 to 7 with the batas and the congas and all of that. So it was based around, you know, doing, you know, Afro-Cuban religious chants and kind of like electrifying them. And I took the band in the studio in the early O's, and I just did not like it. It's that's the thing. It's really African drums, just they're very difficult to record. And the thing that I was trying to get across with that music, it didn't come across in recording. So I just kind of I kind of took.
You didn't put it out.
I didn't put it out. And I needed to kind of rethink how to translate what was coming across live on a record. And it took me a while. And I ended up renaming the project, because when I figured out what to do, and I called the project Elevated Entity, and that's the record that I released.
Ancients Speak.
Ancients Speak was the name of the album.
Listen to a little bit of Canto por Odudua. That's Canto por Odudua, yeah. Featuring Pedrito Martinez.
Yeah, Pedrito. And it's funny, as I was saying, I had this band. And when I had the band, I just would never know who would show up. It's kind of like I had the guy who was in charge of bringing the guys, and they'd always be coming from a religious ceremony. So sometimes it might be 3 people, sometimes it might be 6, sometimes it might be 7. If the gig was supposed to start at 8, it might not start until whenever they showed up. Right. You know, so
so but just all from Cuban. Well,
the guys I had at first were all Puerto Rican guys from the Bronx.
Okay,
you know, so because that's how I found out about it. I mean, the first time I heard about Todd Drum was at a Eddie Palmieri gig, you know, back in the '70s at Mega Evers. So that's my connection to Lukumi religion, Santeria, was through the Bronx. So those are the guys I had in the group. But they came from a ceremony one day. And it's funny because this these kind of stereotypical things. It's always like the New York guys would always be kind of dressed like they just came from some African ceremony. But then they walked in with a bunch of guys wearing gold chains and Kangos like 80s rappers or whatever, and I knew there was a bunch of Cubans because that's how the Cubans always dress. And they had somebody with them, and that was it was like one of the first times Pedrito sang like live in New York.
Wow.
And he kind of jumped up on stage during my show, and he kind of opened his mouth, and it was just like a whole nother level.
Yeah.
You know, when I did this project, of course I had to have Pedrito on there. And for me, the whole thing, that the particular chant he's singing really kind of captured the kind of melodic flavor I was looking for. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for me, I mean, one of the hooks, there's so many hooks and we don't have time to go through because I spent a lot of time thinking about this. Mm. But, you know, the song Afro Blue.
Go ahead and stretch out, Melvin.
Yeah. The song Afro Blue is credited to Mungo Santa Maria. People think of it as a Coltrane song. It's actually Mungo Santa Maria's song, but it's actually an old school African melody that you could either trace back through the Apukwa, which would go back to the Igbo culture, or you could find very similar songs in songs for Orishas, and Odudua is kind of in that vibe, so that's why I kind of really like that one. And you know,
it's a deep link.
Yeah. So then that's kind of what I was going for with that record, was making those connections between. I wanted to make a kind of spiritual record that wasn't a gospel record. And I mean, it's funny now because now in 18, it's that kind of music is kind of back in style. Like everybody's trying to make like spiritual. It's a big thing, like with the new London scene. Everybody's like making spiritual jazz. Mm-hmm. But when I made that record, which I guess it came out in 10, you know, people were still kind of thinking about connections. But for me, the big thing is I wanted to connect it with as you talked about heritage, I also look the other way. I want to connect with the next generation.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure I had some hip hop in there. I wanted to make sure that all the commonalities came out. So I had my nephew and who actually my who was not a professional musician now, but at that time he was the head of a Zulu Nation chapter, so in one of the Brooklyn Zulu Nation chapters. So he's very deep into hip hop culture. So I had him and his boy on the record rapping. We did a lot of the actual recording in Salvador da Bahia, Brazil. Wow. So I had that connection. Mm-hmm. And I had Amayo from Antibalas, who's, you know, straight from the source, Nigeria, you know, who's into the religion as well. So I wanted all the, plus he's doing the Fela thing too. So
right.
I just wanted to kind of connect the family. Well, it's like music, a family reunion, this record.
But, the music always being spiritual, but here it's like an explicit, you made these connections.
Yeah.
Very clear.
Yeah.
And it brings a certain mystery to the music, to all the songs on that record, Ancient Speak. But also, you feel it. You feel the connection to ritual and magic.
Yeah, and that I kind of explicitly wanted to do that. I mean, it's undercurrent on a lot of what I do, but that project was an explicit project. It's also an undercurrent in the term. As Father Unknown is the same, not the same. I mean, because, you know, the same basic idea.
You're talking about that first track we heard.
The Harriet Tubman track. Because, you know, you talk about, it turns up in the strangest places. Like when you think about techno music, there was a great artist called Drexia. And Drexia's whole thing was this, he made up his own mythological system, you know, which, you know, his music was based on these people that had been thrown overboard during the Middle Passage who developed lungs. You know, so there's a lot of time in, you know, African Americans spend a lot of time thinking about Africa, you know, not the real Africa. Vernon Reed calls it artificial Africa. We have this idea of what we think Africa is. And, you know, Black Panther being the latest iteration of that same concept.
You mean that wasn't the reality?
It's a reality, you know. But, you know, that anyway, the point being this, like, the mythological systems that we build, you know, there's a lot of music built around, you know, these personal mythologies, whether it's George Clinton with P-Funk or Sun Ra,
right.
Or, you know, Drexia. And this is not as overt, but it's kind of like looking at the roots of how you would do something like that.
Hmm. Well, speaking about that, you have a track called Pete's Mojo, and it's on this project, I guess, few years after Elevated Entities album, right?
Yeah. I mean,
maybe three or four years later. Yeah. It's called Freedom
Downloads. Freedom Downloads. Yeah, that was when the era when record labels had basically fallen apart, and before we had this sort of renaissance of the kind of things that, you know, my crew of people does. So basically, I just put these things out online just to make sure that they would get out there.
Wow.
And it's funny about the Pete's Mojo part, because I'm gonna actually pull that down. You can play it today.
Okay. Well, it features Pete Cozy, the guitarist.
Because that's actually part of a project that I didn't finish.
Uh-huh.
And the backstory, and it's interesting because there's always a backstory with my stuff. And the backstory of that is that the idea from this project came from a good friend of mine, who's in the last 2 years became really famous as a visual artist, which is kind of, we're all very happy for him. Mm. A man named Arthur Jaffa, mm-hmm. who, and Arthur is somebody that, you know, it's I always tell people that, you know, there's a certain set of people that think me and my friends are geniuses. But among me and my friends, who everybody thinks is geniuses, we have one person we think is a genius. And that person is AJ, Arthur Jaffa. Mm-hmm. And AJ had this, gave me the idea, which he actually used himself. We did last year. But his idea was basically the idea he gave me was to have a group of musicians play along to the Bitches Brew record and then remove the record and make a record with what's left. Mm-hmm. And I actually went and started doing that. And Pete's Mojo Pod is one of the songs from those sessions.
Is that right?
Yeah. What ended up happening is that year ended up being the year of the Bitches Brew anniversary, which was like 4 or 5 years ago now. So there was like two bands doing, and I just didn't want to do it that year. And, but in the meantime, AJ has used a similar idea. We did a thing last year at the Serpentine Gallery called a, what did AJ call that thing? Extraordinary, something about extraordinary renditions. We did this project, it's a similar idea with a piece of gospel music that with a band that was myself, Jason Moran, Steve Coleman, the great rapper Kakai, my boy Michael Gore, and Morgan Kraft on guitar. So after we did that, I was kind of like, you know what, I kind of need to not let this record sit. So I think within this next 6 months, I'm going to finish up this project and put it out.
Okay, so we'll just play a little bit of Pete's Mojo.
Well, you can go ahead and play it. It's just like, you know, this is good, you know, for the people, for the people who are interested enough to come hear this, they'll hear this. Otherwise, no one else is going to hear it.
Can you talk about Pete Cozy a little bit?
Papa Pete, I love Pete to death. I mean, one of the fun facts about Pete is that Pete is one of the original AACM guys.
Mm.
And actually, the first meetings, Pete's mother ran a rec center on the south side of Chicago, and that's the place where they had the first AACM meetings. So in addition to being a member of part of the whole Rotary Connection crew and the chess session guy and the guitar player on those classic
1970s Miles Davis records.
And even before that, Electric Mud, which my friends in that other world told me that that's the record that Led Zeppelin used to listen to before they went out on stage.
Mm.
So he's the guitar player on that. And of course, the 70s Miles records. In addition to all of that, he's also an AACM guy.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's like, it's almost like he's like the template for what I'm doing in a certain kind of way, just in terms of
representing how he's all the facets.
Yeah, he's strong. He is an original member of Earth, Wind & Fire.
Yeah,
and you know, he's also came to town to play with Lester Bowie. So he's got all of these things covered. And
yeah,
love Pete. Miss him. Think about him all
the
time.
So Harriet Tubman put out a record called Ascension a few years back.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 years, something like that.
Yeah, I guess the record came out in, 11 maybe.
A recording of John Coltrane's piece, Ascension.
Yeah.
With a double trio, so you and J.T. Lewis and Brandon Ross, with Ron Miles on, I guess, cornet trumpet, and two DJ sampler players, DJ Logic and...
And DJ Singe.
Singe.
Who teaches at MIT now.
I was so mesmerized by one of these pieces that's called Ascension on the record that I want to try to fit the whole track in. It's 7 minutes long, but it's so good. And if you know Ascension, you know, I played it once with the Rova Sax Quartet in a double quartet with Rafe Malik. And Wadada was on some of it. And having gotten my head wrapped around the inner themes within the music, and I put it on, and at first I was like, okay, well, I'm not really. Then I started to hear everybody referencing the melodic material and bouncing it back and forth, and it's really a masterpiece. And I love Ron Miles, spoken as a true trumpet player, but I really think it's a pretty astounding record and what you guys did with it. So sit tight. We're going to play this track at 7 minutes, and then at the end of that, we'll go straight into the introduction from the piece Nightmaster, that's a solo bass piece by Melvin Gibbs, and then we'll talk a little bit more.
Thank you.
So getting into Ascension, what? How did that? Who decided?
It's funny. It's kind of like I was thinking about that today. In the band, Brandon tends to be the one who like brings the
with the
partnerships, and like he's the one who brought Cassandra in. He's the one who brought in Michelle and DiGicello. I brought in a couple of people here and there, but that's tends to be Brandon's thing. Mm-hmm. As you can tell by what we do, where we've been ranging, I tend to think a lot about a lot of things. So I tend to kind of be like the kind of, hey, let's try that. I'm like the, I don't want to say I'm the idea guy, but I spend a lot of time. I have so many ideas that it just ends up by default because I have so many that, you know, even if you threw 90% of them away, there's still a whole bunch of them there. So the original idea for this project was something that we instituted in a slightly different way this year, which originally the original idea was I wanted to do free jazz with a double quartet, one of the quartets being all DJs. And I had found the four DJs and Ron was going to be the additional player with us. And what ended up happening is that two of the DJs dropped out. So I couldn't do the double quartet anymore. So I kind of sat around and I was kind of like, well, what can we do? Because this is, and I kind of just fell on doing Ascension. So, you know, as what tends to happen, because it was my idea, I'm the one who had to sit down and transcribe everything.
Good. Yeah. So fair enough.
Yeah. So I did, you know, my little transcriptions. I didn't dig too deep into it simply because I don't, when you hear the different versions, you hear that they're so drastically different that, you know, to me it was kind of obvious that, okay, it was much more spontaneous composition than what was on the paper. So I kind of kept what was consistently on the paper, and that's kind of what we built around. Just kind of bookend that, this year we ended up doing free jazz. And we did it for the Winter Jazz Festival, and we did, again, like I said, the intergenerational thing. So we brought in James Brandon Lewis Trio, and we had we expanded our quartet out basically by we added Darius to our band.
Darius Jones.
Yeah. And James was the other quartet, so James brought his other trio, and James decided to bring in Jamie Branch as the fourth person in
his
quartet.
Nice.
So that was the double quartet that did free jazz.
Was that recorded?
Not a clean. I mean, we recorded a gig. There's nothing clean.
There's no studio
in the era of the collapse of the record business, one must pay for their own recording session. So at some point, we will get it paid for, and we will do it. But we don't have a clean recording. But yeah. So anyway, that's kind of bookending to going back to Ascension. So yeah. So I really wanted to do something. I just have this thing about people's opinions about free jazz. Mm-hmm.
I'm with you.
Yeah. So I just really, I like exploding that opinion. And Ascension was really very much in that idea. And it's like, so I'm actually really happy with the way it came out. The thing I think that is kind of surprising now, I mean, we did, that concert dates back to the year 2000. I mean, we sat on that thing for literally 10 years before, and, you know, even listening to it now, it's kind of like, okay, there's a whole nother way of thinking about how to intersect with free music that now, I mean, now people like Jamie and James, now that generation of people is starting to think about music the way that our generation thinks about it. And I'm actually really happy to see that. But yeah, for me, it was very, you know, I mean, almost, you know, you try not to fall over into being didactic, and you try not to be, but with free jazz, when we do these projects, I don't feel a problem with being polemical. It is a polemic, you know what I mean? And this one ended up kind of being within, you know, among the set of people that care about these things, you know, there's a bit of controversy about it, you know, because it is a, you know, because the thing about Tubman, is that, like I said, I mean, you know, we were up under Ornette, you know, yeah. Brandon's, you know, Brandon
been
knows
with Henry Threadgill.
Henry Threadgill. It's like you can't mess with our bona fides as far as this music. But what we do just infuriates a certain set of people.
So what was it because there was electric instruments?
Electric,
that was
and because it doesn't sound like
it doesn't sound like the original
free jazz. And it's, uh-huh. But I mean, my whole thing is if Duke Ellington was born today, he'd be using samplers and computers. Right. And it's like the thing is that 60s, late 50s, early 60s people, they were making a statement about the music at the time and the culture at that time. We in 2018 don't need to make the same statement about the music because they already did it. We're supposed to do the next thing past whatever it is they did. And we're supposed to, unfortunately, the flip side of it is, unfortunately, the culture hasn't moved forward that much. So there's still the same cultural problems.
So Harriet Tubman, is that also a reaction to that?
Harriet Tubman's is very specifically about, you know, the three of ours take on, like you said in the beginning, a three of ours take on heritage and what that means for the future. And the fact that, you know, Brandon came, you know, Brandon, I think Brandon's first session was Archie Shepp, mm-hmm. you know, but Brandon plays loud electric guitar and mm-hmm. he plays the, you know, but it's a question of what do you do with that information, you know what I mean? And I think that that's, you know, even, you know, it's been a journey for the people. It's been a journey for the culture, and the culture is in a different place, which is allowing people to hear what we're doing differently. And it's also been a journey for us to kind of finally say, you know, okay, that's great what I got from Henry. And I'm going to keep, you know, that relationship and keep that knowledge and work with data. This is what the sum total of our life experiences taught us about what music should be. And that's kind of, that's kind of where we are with things.
And the record's called The Terror End of Beauty.
The Terror End of Beauty is actually a song that I wrote, again, you know, me being me. I wrote the song for Sonny Chirac. And it's very evocative for me of what I got from Sonny and what he's about and how he approached music. The thing that people maybe don't know about Sonny is Sonny was actually a singer, too. Sonny had a doo-wop band. And a lot of what Sonny did was these very simple cellular things. A lot of what, that he would kind of pull apart. So what I wanted to do, again, thinking about it in terms of my generation, I'm not doo-wop era. I'm like soul R&B era. So we kind of did this kind of soul R&B melody, and we just pulled it apart. And that's kind of what the song is. That's the short version of what we did.
Wow. Great. Well, Melvin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Really fantastic music and incredible stories. And I feel like we probably just scratched the surface.
Mm. Well, I was happy to share. I was glad to share.
There's plenty more for people to listen to. Yeah. And I'm just so honored that you made time to do this.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And I just want to shout out, you know, the guys in Tubman, you know, Brandon and JT. Going to shout out, well, you talked about Pete. Who did I not talk about?
And you're doing, it's on vinyl on Early Future.
Yes, the record. Oh, the very important
CD
thing.
CD and
the record is available for pre-order now. You can pre-order the vinyl on Early Future Records Bandcamp. And depending on when this podcast actually airs, the digital may be available for pre-order on Sunnyside as well. The CD may be available for pre-order, but the vinyl can be pre-ordered now.
So if we're talking in 2018, so if you're listening to this 5 years from now, you can definitely.
Yeah. Okay. If we're now in October 2018.
Yeah. And probably it'll be released in November.
In 2018, in October 2018, the record is available. The record will be available on Early Future Records on vinyl and Sunnyside Records on digital. If you hear this podcast before the official release date, you can pre-order the vinyl. And the vinyl pre-order comes with the digital. If you
great.
You know. So if you hear this after the official release today, you can just go directly to Sunnyside. If you don't want the vinyl, and go directly to Sunnyside and buy the digital. If you hear it after that, you know, keep an eye out, because, you know, depending on how many years later this is, the music business changes. But for now, the vinyl is
there. May be new formats.
Exactly. For now, you can find, you know, digital through Sunnyside and vinyl through Early Future Records.
Melvin Gibbs, thanks so much. The Terror End of Beauty.